Bhagavad Gita as it is, chapter 6, text number 45. Pratyatnadyatmananastu Yogi Samshudakya Bhisha Aneka Janma Samsidas Toyiti Paramgitim. Pratyatnat by rigid practice. Yatamana endeavoring to and yogi such a transcendentalist. Samshuddha washed off. Kilvisha all of whose sins. Aneka after many. Janma, births. Samsida, having achieved perfection. Tata, thereafter. Iti, attains. Param, the highest. Kitim, destination. And when the yogi engages himself with sincere endeavor and making further progress, being washed of all contaminations, and ultimately having achieving perfection, after many births of practice, attains the supreme goal. Purport: a person born in a particularly righteous, aristocratic, or sacred family becomes conscious of his favorable condition for executing yoga practice. With determination, therefore, he begins his unfinished task. Thus, he completely cleanses himself of all material contaminations. When he is finally free from all contamination, attains the supreme perfection, Krishna consciousness. Krishna consciousness is the perfect stage of being freed of all contaminations, as confirmed in the Bhagavad Gita, 7:28. Yesham dvandakitam vapam janana punya karmanam te dvandva mava nirmukva vajante mam jada vrataha. After many births of executing pious activities, one is completely freed from all contamination, from all illusory dualities, one becomes engaged in devotional, transcendent loving service of the Lord. Pratnatnyadyatmananas tu yogi samsidya kilpisha aneka janma samsidas tatoyati paramgitim. And when the yogi engages himself in sincere endeavor in making further progress, being washed of all contaminations, and ultimately achieving perfection after many years births of practice, attains the supreme goal. Krishna makes it seem all very easy. Just keep on practicing, and eventually get the supreme goal. But it doesn't quite work like that. That's why, generally speaking, many yogis start, and they don't finish the process. Because it depends on many favorable circumstances. First of all, you have to have the determination to even follow the process, as Krishna has explained before, as well as the proper teacher to show you what the process is. And of course, in Kali Yuga, people don't have determination, nor do they have a proper teacher. Even the best teachers in Kali Yuga are not interested in meditating on the super soul. They expert, some of them, at asana, which is supposed to be just two things, sthira and sukha. Namely, sukha is comfortable, just like you're sitting on a cushion. So if it's comfortable, we call it an asana. And sthira, you should be stable. You can sit with it. Head and neck erect, so you can stare at the tip of your nose, and practice the pranayama system, and then become pratyahara, detach especially from eating. Ahara means to eat. So eating is generally in different phases. The most obvious is eating with our mouth and our tongue, but less obvious is eating with breathing is also eating. And seeing is also eating. That's why you're supposed to look at the tip of your tongue, because it probably doesn't taste very good. But we look with our eyes, we're actually eating, trying to relish certain sights, certain things. So that's also, the eyes are eating, the fire of digestion is also, is a part of the fire of digestion, which is one of the airs of life. We have apana vayu, we have samana vayu, we have jnana vayu, which is in charge of jnana is all pervading. So samana vayu is in charge of equalizing, but and then we have prana vayu. And what's the one in charge of digestion again? Samana, it must be samana vayu. So in every sense, living means to eat. And if we can digest, that's called health. If we can't digest, that's called disease. Disease comes simply from lack of digestion. But sometimes we don't recognize we're eating in many different ways. To exist means to eat. So pratyahara, stop eating. Mat karo. Don't eat. Or reducing it gradually. And then after that, then you can begin with dhyana. Oh, dharana, actually. Try to capture Krishna within the mind. Like Dhruva Maharaj, he went through the yoga process in 6 months. And part of it was giving up eating. Mainly it was giving up eating. And then because he was giving up eating, he was also learning how to concentrate his mind upon the deity he had formulated in Vrindavan, because he went to the right place. He had the right spiritual master, Narada Muni. And he had the right process, chanting Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. The first month, he only ate kapita fruit. Did you ever have any kapita fruit?
It's like a very dry, tasteless.
Yeah, one part in that chapter probably says kapita fruit is tasteless and even the monkeys won't eat it. And then another part he says kapita fruit is very delicious. So I guess if you're hungry enough, everything is delicious. So Dhruva Maharaj only ate kapita fruit every third day. He was hungry. And then the second month, every sixth day, he only drank some water. But of course it was pure water. It's probably, if we had that water now, we'd be intoxicated by it. And then every ninth day, he finally took one, second month it was leaves that fell from the tree. Luckily it was autumn, so he got something to eat. And then he ate, only drank water. And then for the fourth month, he only took a breath of air every so many days. And then he stopped breathing and stood on one leg, concentrated his mind upon Vishnu. So if one can stop eating, one can stop drinking, one can stop breathing, there's nothing else to do but to concentrate on Vishnu. What else are you going to do? Because our whole material existence, everything, although we make it very complicated, ultimately what we're trying to do is survive. That people have, one industrialist who was explaining what he meant by reducing the population by his methods, said the reason why his explanation is that in underdeveloped countries, people have many children because when they get older, they want the children to take care of them. So if you reduce the amount of death through their particular process of vaccination, then the result is that children will live longer and they won't have to have so many children. and therefore will reduce the population that way. Anyhow, it may make sense to some people. But the idea is that people have children basically because they hope the children are going to grow up and support them, help them in their old age. Because nowadays, probably the last people who are going to help you are your children. Especially in the Western world, they put them in some old age home. But in any case, that's the idea is children, house, food, insurance, because we don't want to die. That's our first priority. Survive. Anamaya. Eat and then pranamaya. Somehow or another, keep on breathing. And then manamaya. Think of something nice when you're existing. Mostly, think of something nice means think of eating, sleeping, mating, and defending, so you feel that you're going to survive. Deha, patya, kaladradishu, atma, sanyeshva, satsupi, tesham, pramato, nidanam, pashana, pina, pashati. That, when he has the body, the wife, the children, they're the sanyeshu. They're the soldiers, protect us. But pashana, pina, pashati. But no one gets protected because no one survives. But everyone's trying to survive. So the yogi sits there trying to get rid of all these anxieties, actually. He does it by a process, of course. First of all, to be able to sit in one place and not be disturbed, especially in the middle of a jungle. That's why you cover it with a deer skin. Apparently, snakes don't like deer skins. And a soft cloth, and cover it with kusha grass, because kusha grass helps meditation. Soft cloth, so you don't have to sit on the kusha grass. And a deer skin to protect yourself from snakes. And hopefully from tigers, too. Because I don't know what tiger sees a snake skin. Deer skin, I guess, you figure there's no... Someone ate it already, might as well know. No use taking a second bite. Doesn't look like there's much meat left on the thing. And then sit there steadily, do pranayama, because pranayama actually takes away anxiety. It actually calms the mind. Because even more anxiety is our anxiety over breathing. We don't realize how much breathing influences our anxiety, or just our level of consciousness. Therefore, most people are not breathing properly because they're full of anxiety, and their breath is extremely short. So when you control the breath, then you actually control the mind. The mind, in the sense, the mind becomes pacified. I'm getting enough air, I'm not suffocating. Most people feel like they're suffocating all the time. That's why. So, if you can get enough air, then you can actually, you don't really care so much about food. You can gradually reduce the food because you feel satisfied. The mind's not so much anxious. And then as one reduces the food, the anxiety, what's my future? Because we're always worried, whether we're aware of it or not. Am I going to get something to eat tomorrow? When people become jobless, it's not that they're worried that they won't be able to work. They're worried about whether they're going to be able to eat or not. Or what they're going to be able to eat. It says that people will be so much anxiety in Kali Yuga that they're going to live on leaves and twigs or something? On roots. They'll have to flee into the forest and live on roots and bark or whatever it was. So there's a science, and it's quite a simple science. Modern society is very, very complicated, and the yoga system that's practiced nowadays, people don't even realize what it's for. Most of people practice yoga to reduce weight so they can eat more. That's what Prabhupada wrote to me. I was practicing Hatha Yoga before I joined as a method of self-realization. And I had a job as a model in an art school, so I got paid for it, doing yoga exercises 2-3 hours a day. And at the same time, eventually I took up the chanting of Hare Krishna. But even while I was in the temple, I used to do yoga exercises. My roommate also. And when I got initiated, my roommate also got initiated. We wrote the letters to Prabhupada. And for me, Prabhupada just said, you know, engage yourself strictly in the activities of devotional service. But I guess my roommate must have asked him about doing yoga exercises. And Prabhupada wrote him back. He said, no, no. He said, this yoga exercise is just so people don't gain weight. There's no need to do it. So I was a yoga teacher for some time. And most of the people who came were ladies because they wanted to lose weight. So that's not yoga. Of course, it's not the yoga that's described in the Bhagavatam. And I don't know how many lost weight. I think, you get a little flexible. In any case, the actual process is quite elaborate. You have to go through quite a bit of austerity. So it means you have to have suffered quite a bit in the material world in order to actually go through a determination to give up your association with everyone, to go into a forest and sit there and just try to, learn, sit up straight, control your breath, and withdraw your mind from all other activities, and then maybe for some start thinking about the super soul. But for most of them, they just think about Brahman. Or even if they think about the super soul, the majority think they are the super soul. And therefore, the amount of success rate in the Hatha Yoga system, maybe previously we have in the nectar of devotion, we have that Brahman who was very poor. And he heard, if you simply go to the forest, if you simply go and you meditate on deity worship, then you'll get the same result as if you were actually performing the deity worship. So the first thing he did, after hearing from the learned devotees how to practice this meditation, he did pranayama. And Prabhupada says in the Nectar of Devotion that at that time pranayama was quite common. Everyone did pranayama, especially if they're interested in meditation. And of course, he was able to go through the elaborate process of meditation, although it doesn't describe that he went through the whole Ashtanga Yoga system. But he was able to meditate on elaborate deity worship. But for those who are conditioned by material nature, then the process becomes more elaborate because people can't sit in one still. They can't control their breath. They can't withdraw their mind from their anxieties. But after many, many bursts of practice, one is able to do it to the extent that this particular Brahmin was able to simply sit in one place, do some pranayama, and then meditate upon deity worship of the Supreme Lord. And he got the same result as if he was doing deity worship. Lord Narayan came in his Vaikuntha airplane, or he had his Vaikuntha airplane come, picked the Brahmin up and he took him back to Vaikuntha. And all the Lakshmis found out why Lord Narayan was laughing, because the Brahmin had stuck his finger in the sweet rice in his meditation and his finger got burnt. And he looked at it, he woke up, looked at his finger, it was all burnt. Couldn't understand, he thought it was just meditation. And then Lord Narayan brought him back to Vaikuntha. So that's the aim. What's being described here is quite positive, that there is a process if you want to go through it, but it takes many, many bursts of practice. But you'll get the opportunity, as it says here, you're born in a righteous family, or an aristocratic family, or in a sacred family, but the odds are that's one of the reasons why it takes a long time. Because most people who get born in an aristocratic family, which means a mercantile family, generally they get deviated. If you're born in a very opulent family, with a lot of wealth, people have wealth because they want to enjoy. And therefore, it's very rare, like Lord Buddha, he gave up the wealth and went to the forest to meditate. Generally, people get wealth and they exploit it to the maximum. And Brahmin family, as we find in the case of Jadvara, who is practically perfected yogi, that his brothers, who were his father, was trying to train him up as a Brahmin, trying to teach him Gayatri Mantra, etc., etc. Jadvarata didn't want to get entangled, so he acted like he was dumb and deaf, couldn't learn anything. So his father just gave up and let him meditate, let him think about Krishna rather than going through all these rituals. But we find his brothers, they were all Brahmins, but they were not very Krishna conscious. So though one may be born in a Brahmin family, it doesn't necessarily mean that one will take up the process of Krishna consciousness either. And even born in a sacred family, as we can see, many children of our devotees are born with an opportunity from the beginning. You see the little children with cartels, the chanting, they have a little dhoti, and they grow up not exactly pure devotees. You know. And sometimes just to prove that they have no ties, they usually become sometimes even more absorbed in sense gratification than ordinary children, just to prove that, you know, they've broken off from the religion. The Amish, they have their children, it's obligatory for their children to go outside of their Amish community for at least 1 year, I believe, so they can experience what it's like to be in the liberated world. And if they want, they can stay in that community, or they can come back. Because otherwise you're in that community and you're thinking, oh, if only I could be in the community, outside this Amish community, then I could really enjoy. So they go out and they see how people are so-called enjoying, and I guess most of them come back because they don't want to so-called enjoy anymore like that. So that's the same thing with the yogis. They, by pious activity, they go up to the heavenly planets for a while, and then they come down, they're born in these families, and usually they deviate, and they get fried, and then they come back, and they start practicing again, and that's why it takes many, many births, because you're just going up and down from the heavenly planets, back to the earth planet, maybe you take a visit sometimes to Yamaloka, say hello to Yamaraj, let him know that you're still around. And then you come back again and you start the yoga practice all over again, like Vishwamrita Muni. Obviously, Vishwamrita Muni was practicing for a long, long time before he could practice for 60,000 years at a time. And still he got into trouble. Imagine having the power to meditate for 60,000 years. I don't think he did it all. You know, I think they had probably... He wasn't sitting there for 60,000 years. That's Lutum. But he was meditating for 60,000 years. And then falling down and having the determination for 100 years and then having the determination to get up again and start practicing yoga again. And then after another 60,000 years, falling down again. And then getting up again and starting all over again from scratch and meditating for another 60,000 years. And the only thing he achieved is he got second initiation. Mm-hmm. He finally got second. I mean, that's really determination. Imagine if we had our devotees, you had to go through the process to get second initiation. How many Brahmins would we have? Mm-hmm. In any case, it's a very difficult process in any age, even in Satya Yuga, when they had practically no distractions, and physical fitness, which is unimaginable due to the purity of the situation. Still, it took Kardama Muni 10,000 years to finally see the Supersoul, to meet Krishna. Therefore, as always concluded, that the only practical way is to chant Hare Krishna. And we should also judge, though, that by chanting, gradually we become detached from sense gratification. That the more one is able to focus the mind upon Krishna, then the more one becomes not distasteful, but detached from sense gratification. I guess distasteful the higher taste, one ceases the lower one. So the six Goswamis give us the example, especially Raghunath Das Goswami, eating a little pad of buttermilk every day, every other day, a little bit of, and sometimes not sleeping for 1 hour and sometimes not sleeping at all. And bowing down the schedule measurement, this is the example of perfection by any process, but always remembering Radha and Krishna. Radha, Krishna, Gunas, Madhira, Madhurima, Nandena, Samohito. What is that? Jatva, Torna, Mashesha, Mandalapati, Shrenim, Sadatu, Chavan, Budvadina, Gunesha, Ko, Karunaya, Kopi, Nakanta, Shito, Kopi, Baba, Samrita, Dilahari, Kolo, Lamogna, Moho, Bande Rupa Sanatana Raguyago Shri Jiva Gopalago. So the six Goswamis, they give us the example of how we can get the same perfection that took Kardamom Muni 10,000 years. We can get it even in one life if we actually simply chant our rounds every day with care and attention, bow down before the devotees with reverence, take to the process of sadhana bhakti, and then we can develop, eventually we come to the stage of bhava, where we become absorbed in the mood of the gopis, the same feelings, our normal feelings, devotional feelings, and then we can, all these other things become unattractive as we advance. And therefore, even though they were aristocratic, they had unlimited wealth, Rupa Goswami had a bowl full of gold coins, and they were government officials. They were controlling West Bengal. They had immense power. Still, they gave it up and went to the Vrindavan. And they lived like ordinary mendicants begging from door to door. Prabhupada said, ordinarily, if one tried to do that, like there was one, C.R. Das, he was a very wealthy lawyer. He was making 40,000 rupees a month, which nowadays would be at least $40,000 a month, if not more. And he was fantastically rich, and he gave an immense amount of money in charity. And he joined, when he joined Gandhi's movement, Gandhi told him that you should give up this wealth, and you should join. You should give up being a lawyer and making all this money and simply work for us. So it just so happens to C.R. Das, he was unhappy. And one day, before that, before he joined Gandhi's movement, he was never satisfied, although he had a fabulous amount of wealth. So his wife was looking at him and said, C.R. Das, you have all this money, you have all this fame and prestige and everything else. Why are you so unhappy? Why are you so morose? What do you want to be anyhow? So he pointed to a mendicant in the street. He said, I want to be like him. So Krishna fulfills all desires. And Gandhi came to him and said, you have to give up your money, and you have to become a mendicant. So he said, all right, I always want to become a mendicant. So he did it, and he died in a couple of months later. He said he was so heartbroken, he couldn't, Gandhi was giving him enough to live on. And he gave up this this enormous amount of wealth, and he was living so austerely, he just couldn't tolerate it, because he was so much used to his opulent life. But Prabhupada said the six Goswamis, they had even more opulence, but still they gave it up as tuchava, as something insignificant, because they were so much ecstatic, they had so much love for Krishna and for the devotees, that so much pleasure in devotional service, that everything else seemed insignificant. So that's why the yogis are able to do it also. If those who go through the process and life after life, eventually they get a taste, and then they actually become Krishna conscious. They, as it says in another verse, Yatra paramate chitam niruda yoga sevaya yatra chevatmanatmanam pachanamini tushati sukama yandikam yatad buddhigrayam atendriyam veti yatrana chayvayam sitam chalati tatvata yam lava chapalam lava manyate nadikam tata yasmin sito nagduke na guru napi vichalyate tam vidya dukasam yogam vi yogam yoga samgitaha. That state of perfection is called transfer samadhi. One's mind is completely refrained from all material mental activities, by the practice of yoga. This is characterized by one's ability to see the self by the pure mind and to relish and rejoice in that self. In that joyous state, one is situated in transcendental happiness, enjoys transcendental happiness through his senses. This is indeed actual freedom. One is never disturbed in spite of the greatest difficulty. This is actually freedom from all miseries arising from material contact. So that's the same thing. The goal is to think about Krishna, to actually meditate upon Krishna, and we have the opportunity to do it without going through this extremely difficult process. It's not meant to become flexible or to lose weight or even to have a peaceful mind. It's ultimately meant to just think about Krishna. And we were given a process which is extremely simple, extremely straightforward, and if we accept the process, that it's possible that even one lifetime we can reach perfection. So I'll stop there. Thank you. Any questions, comments? Our technician is... Yeah, I don't know. There it is. Just see. There's a God.
Normally, long exhalation cools the mind down, which is what usually happens when one chants japa. Would there be some useful pranayam to make devotees more alert and less sleepy during japa and the class, our classes? Some pranayama that would make devotees more...
If we chant using our tongue and our mouth and our lips and breathe, and if you're tired, then better to stand up. I mean, you try to practice pranayama when you're tired, you'll probably fall asleep quicker. Did you ever try and practice pranayama when you're tired?
I have insomnia. I have trouble.
I've been at yoga classes. I was in one at Pune with the Iyengars, and his daughter was doing pranayama classes every evening, so I was going to the pranayama classes. And I couldn't hear it because, you know, it was India. India, you know, they have no conception of quiet. Outside there was the road was going, you know, the cars were going down the road. And unless you were right next to Gita Iyengar, you couldn't hear a word she was saying. All you can hear is everyone breathing. So I was breathing also. So if you're tired, better go to sleep. But if you want to, if you're tired when chanting japa, better stand up. Stand up and chant clearly. If you chant with your tongue and mind, just to actually concentrate on chanting nicely, you can't really fall asleep. You're actually trying to chant properly and listening.
And the class?
The class, stand up. Stand up.
It's dangerous.
Take notes, actually. What's that? Take notes. Because, you know.
Copious notes.
What's that? Some notes. Take something that you might find meaningful. Otherwise, people write down notes, which is good. And then, you know, you get a whole pile of notes and you put it somewhere. It's like, you can't remember anything that was in the notes. You never look at the notes. Maybe you look at the notes 3 years later and go, what was this? Yes.
Is it possible that some of the so-called homeless or hobos or something could be continuing from their... maybe having some attachment to that lifestyle from some yoga practice before?
Maybe for, in your transcendental vision. Obviously it wasn't executed perfectly. No, okay. Yogi doesn't mean being a hobo. I mean,
I mean, excluding drunkards, let's say, or.
Well, in one sense, they probably just. When I was in India, I used to go every day. We had a walk to the Iyengar Institute. It was in the morning. We had an early morning class. And you'd see all these people sleeping on the street, you know, the homeless. And they were sleeping much better than I could ever sleep. I mean, they were completely peaceful because they had nothing to worry about. They didn't worry about paying bills or, you know, more or less they knew where to get something to eat and didn't have to worry about anything. So they slept very peaceful. Like the dogs sleep, they don't. Once in a while a dog may go, wow. But generally speaking, there's nothing to worry about. So, similarly, the homeless, they don't have to pay rent. They don't have to pay electricity, they don't have to pay education, light, nothing. So they're pretty peaceful. As a matter of fact, a lot of people in India, they get some free apartment. They get subsidized by the government. And then they rent the apartment out and they go and live in the street in some shack or something. They just make money from the rented apartment because they're used to it. Not recommended, though. Anything else? Thank you very much. Grandaraj Bhagavad Gita Ki Jai.